Blog Talk Radio.
Talking Law.
Talking Law.
Talking Law.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser.
You can't handle the truth.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser analyzes criminal cases in the news, trends in the law, and covers all legal current events.
Overruled.
Our host, criminal defense attorney in New York, Daniel Hochheiser. Each week, Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser features newsmakers, attorneys, media personalities, celebrities, politicians, business people, and so much more.
Straight talk.
No nonsense. Here's Talking Law with your host, Dan Hochheiser.
May 27th, 2015. Good morning, Talking Law fans. Welcome to the show. This is your host, Dan Hochheiser, broadcasting to you live from Lower Manhattan, just east of the Freedom Tower. We have a fantastic show for you today. Before we get started, I want to remind everybody to please like our Facebook page at facebook.com/talkinlaw, T-A-L-K-I-N, law, L-A-W, to keep up with all the latest updates about the show. Follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, H-O-C-H-H-E-I-S-E-R. And if you like, you can even send me an email, talkinlaw@gmail.com, talkinlaw@gmail.com. We have a great show. What are we going to do today? First, we're going to do the question of the day about police-involved homicides. Then we are lucky to have former Congressman Bob Ney, former congressman from Ohio, who is going to help us break down the various Republican presidential candidates out there, help us make sense of it. Then we're going to answer the question of the day, and then we will go to Beth Karras, who will speak to us about the Colorado theater shooting trial and, time permitting, the D.C. quadruple murder case, and perhaps we may get to the Dewey LaBeouf opening statements, which are ongoing this morning. Now, let me introduce, before we introduce, the question of the day. Question. In the United States since 2005, of the 54 law enforcement officers charged with shooting and killing a person in the line of duty, how many of the 54 have been convicted? Now, Bob Ney is a former Republican United States Congressman from the great state of Ohio. He is the author of Sideswiped, Lessons Learned, Courtesy of the Hitmen of Capitol Hill. Bob, are you with me?
Yes, Dan. How are you?
I'm doing great. I want to thank you so much for coming back on the show. For those of our listeners who didn't have the good fortune to hear our interview the first time, you can go back to January 21st, a little more than 4 months ago, when the congressman came on the show, and we really had a very interesting discussion. And just so you know how grateful I am to you, that show really was perhaps our most highly rated show from our listeners. So I can't thank you enough for coming back.
Sure. Happy to be on.
Now, before we get into it, I want to talk about the various Republican presidential candidates who are vying for position, perhaps to take on Hillary Clinton. I want to play you a piece of tape from a wise man who spoke to us about 4 months ago. Mark, play the tape.
I believe you're going to have Elizabeth Warren's going to make Hillary Clinton make some statements, but you're going to have Hillary Clinton. So, and I think for the Democratic side, I think that's great. For the Republican side, they've got to take a deep breath. If they do Mitt Romney and Jeb Bush, I think it's over with. Hillary Clinton is the president. I'd like to see, you know, some fresh faces. Now, I'm going to throw out a couple of names. People are going to go, you got to be kidding. I know Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, gave a bad presentation at his, you know, slap at the State of the Union a couple of years ago. But I think a Bobby Jindal, I think a Rand Paul would make a fascinating race, actually. But if they go to, you know, Ted Cruz, Rick Santorum, Jeb Bush, and Mitt Romney, it's done. I mean, I'd technically love to see a female candidate in the Republican Party go head-on-head like Senator Kelly Ayotte or someone head on head with Hillary Clinton, I think it would be a healthy race.
Congressman, that's what you said about 4 months ago, and I'm looking at the Republican presidential contenders, and I do see one woman, Carly Fiorina, former CEO, I believe, of Hewlett-Packard. What do you think of her?
Well, she's not getting anywhere. She's just not, you know, in the rank whatsoever. Now, there is, nobody will say this name, period. Jennifer Carroll. Nobody knows who she is, but she actually was Lieutenant Governor of Florida, and African-American, was in the military. You know, a name like that, again, that's nowhere on the radar screen right now. But I don't think Fiorina with, you know, is going to make it just way, way down. Of course, you know, some of the national mainstream media is deciding, well, if you don't get a certain percentage, we're not even going to put you in the debates on television, which I think is wrong.
Yeah, I saw that article, and they're going to have limits to, I don't know what it was, maybe 10 or 12 candidates who can be in the debates.
Right.
But then I think maybe it was CNN, if I'm not mistaken, is going to have like a varsity debate and then a junior varsity debate with the second tier people.
That's right. Yeah, Fox was going to, you have to have a certain percentage you're not on. So Santorum's off. You know, the lady you just mentioned's off. I think Huckabee, they would be off of it. And then CNN was going to have a two-level, two-tier. I mean, this is just getting to the point where, you know, as we look at this in the process, and you've got Jeb Bush, you know, still out there and has the money, as they try to maneuver through the states, New Hampshire first, Iowa, et cetera. I still argue, my friends on the Republican side have just gotten furious with me, but if it is Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush, I don't care if they find four other servers with Hillary Clinton of emails. If it's Jeb Bush, he's doomed.
Well, let's talk about the Hillary Clinton emails for a minute. Mm-hmm. You know, that for our listeners who maybe haven't been paying as close of attention to those issues as you and I have, this involves the so-called Benghazi scandal, where Hillary Clinton apparently had personal email accounts, which she was
right,
using to communicate with government people for official purposes. And she claims that she had personal emails on a server at home, which she deleted and destroyed. Are the Republicans going to get any traction with that? Is that going to go anywhere?
No, it's not, but because other Secretary of States did it. And now Hillary Clinton's been a little off her target, as we say, off square a little bit, don't get me wrong, and probably wishes she would have just used a government account. The first Secretary of State to do it is Secretary of State Kerry. Colin Powell didn't do it. But I think here's what's going to happen. This is a prediction I'll make. You're going to see more sensationalism on Sidney Blumenthal, for example, and he's a former White House guy and advisor to Clinton. They pulled a couple of these emails saying, well, why did she pass on, Hillary Clinton, pass on information that he dug up on intelligence on Benghazi? Hey, if you're in public office, friends pass things to you. Hey, I found this, I found that. Hillary Clinton clearly passed it on. I don't think you're going to see a silver bullet here, period. But you're going to see, if with 55,000 emails, you're going to see all kinds of things where she passed on this request from a friend or this information, which is normal course of business. But right now they're actually going to subpoena Mr. Blumenthal. For what reason? I mean, I've got to throw that out there. What is the reason for subpoena? Because he said to the Secretary of State, I think there's some intelligence information here you ought to look at.
You know what?
You're going to see more.
I really think Congressman, I really think that the Sidney Blumenthal issue is much ado about nothing, in my humble opinion.
Right.
I mean, you know, this is a situation where you have a public official who is receptive to other smart people's ideas, and perhaps she said, well, you know, this guy's a smart guy and he has some information. And frankly, if it was the other way around and she didn't pass it on, and not passing it on caused the problem, they would have criticized
right.
her for that. So I don't think the Sidney Blumenthal issue is going to have any legs. The email server thing, as an attorney, as a litigator, you know, that causes me some concern because it does have that whiff of, you know, destruction of evidence and spoliation and this kinds of stuff. So, you know, I'm not sure that was so wise. Perhaps you should have, you know, secured that information someplace and then had, you know, an independent tribunal make that decision. But
you did what you did. And let's throw this out here for a second. Let's say that she's turned over all the emails and there's some missing emails, and all of a sudden they find an email that was sent. They have five of them. It happens to relate to Benghazi. Maybe nothing silver bullet, but it relates to Benghazi, but they weren't on her server. What happens after that? You know, you're a legal guy. The question is going to be raised, what else is out there missing? So, yeah, that's a, you know, maybe a technical problem, but it's a problem.
So let's get back to what you said to our listeners in January about basically what you said, and I think you repeated it today, is that if this comes down to Hillary Clinton versus Jeb Bush, Hillary Clinton wins. My question to you is, why?
Well, because of the fact, and people say to me, let me just clarify this, they'll say, well, Bob, you're saying the Bushes have had it. What about the Clintons? A couple of other factors. First of all, and everybody wants to dismiss, you know, this is Hillary's campaign. I don't care what anybody says. Bill Clinton is riding higher than he's ever ridden in his life on people liking him. Okay, that's a fact. So he is a factor. Whereas George Bush may not be, you know, that popular for his brother. His brother's got to get in there and kind of defend the policies, you know. Well, you know, he was defending his brother on Iraq, but maybe he would have done it. Maybe he would have still invaded. So, you know, he's got some of those problems. But I just look at Jeb Bush himself, forgetting Hillary Clinton for a minute, and he's just not as striking as, for example, Rand Paul on being bold on some issues. He or Rubio or others, he just, when you look at him, he just reminds you of that kind of, you know, overweight executive guy that's kind of a little excited about doing this. He just doesn't have the, you know, the energy out there. And relying on the Bush name a lot, I just don't think that the energy is there. And I think Hillary Clinton still having Bill Clinton is a factor, you know, in the race. Now, of course,
well,
you know,
fortunately, we have the energy on this show. You're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking with former Ohio Congressman Bob Ney, who is the author of Sideswiped, Lessons Learned, courtesy of the Hitmen of Capitol Hill. You can get Bob Ney's book, Sideswiped, on Amazon.com. Bob, let me give you my two cents on Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton's recent performance during the campaign here, or maybe this is before the campaign. I can't even remember who's announced and who hasn't yet. But in terms of Jeb Bush, I was really disturbed that he came off so amateurish in terms of answering this question about whether he would have invaded Iraq today if he knew what he knows now. I don't understand why he didn't anticipate that question and why he didn't realize that, of course, if you knew the information now, you wouldn't do it. You wouldn't go invade the wrong country again. I mean, that's crazy.
I voted to allow for full force and authority for George Bush. I voted for it. I can't even today under the oath we signed, I can't tell you exactly what they showed me that day. But I think if you'd have sat next to me, you might have made the decision I made. Now that that's all over with, if you ask me today, knowing you were showed either idiotic information on intelligence or complete lies, if you say to me, Bob, would you again vote? I'm saying no. They, well, what about Saddam? He's a bad guy. Well, I think the premier of China is a bad guy. I don't see us invading Beijing. I mean, eventually, the people that voted for this, like myself and others, have to say, look, you know, we were lied to. I think the bigger question is, why didn't they get those who lied to us and hold them accountable, including criminally? accountable. That never happened. It all just evaporated. So I think he mishandled the question, and you're right to not anticipate how that's coming up. Look, Hillary Clinton's going to anticipate questions about Bill Clinton. And I'm not saying she's at the best of her game right now, but I'm saying that Jeb Bush is at the worst of his game.
Well, you know, and Jeb Bush, who I think is basically a good man, and I think he's, you know, a smart guy, and, you know, I think, you know, I certainly loved his father. His brother, I'm not sure, did the best job, but, you know, I was surprised that he fumbled that. I thought that was sort of a ground ball that he bobbled. But as to Hillary Clinton, you know, in all fairness, I'm not sure what she's been doing in terms of her stonewalling the media. You know, I know she did come out and finally let somebody from the press ask her a question or two, but, you know, I don't know how she thinks that she's going to carry on a presidential campaign and ignore the media.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm stepping back and looking at this, and if Jeb Bush weren't the factor, and I agree with everything you said about his father and his brother, but if he weren't the factor right now, this would be an absolute out there head-on collision, because with Hillary Clinton, look, she waited how many weeks to even make a statement about the servers? She's gotten off of her game. She really has. She's off her square. She's, I don't know, rusty or stale, whatever you want to call it. But this recent thing of, well, I'll consider talking to you, the media, as she's going around pretending they're not there, I don't know where on earth that strategy comes from. I can appreciate the strategy of having smaller events, don't have the great big rallies, but you can't be running for president and walk around and say, well, you know, I'll talk to you about that when I'm ready. It doesn't cut it. So this is seriously, I think, one of the most bizarre times right now in presidential races I've seen in a couple of decades.
If you don't mind, Congressman, what I'd like to do is I want to go down the list of candidates, Republican candidates, and if you could give me like a few words on each person, I think that would be helpful for the listeners so that they can get an idea of who's who. Scott Walker.
Well, you know, Scott Walker, who everybody says is secretly backed by the Koch brothers or publicly backed by the Koch brothers, and you know, Harry Reid, the leader of the Senate, by the way, tried to nationalize the Koch brothers with people and spend a lot of money, and that really just didn't work for what he tried to do. But Scott Walker, putting aside Koch brothers or not, I want to put that aside for a second, financing. Scott Walker is a player in this thing. Just like if my Ohio, you know, governor got in this, but Scott Walker is a player. He's a governor, very controversial, anti-labor, but Scott Walker, I think, is a definite player in this.
Marco Rubio.
Marco Rubio, I also think, is a player in the sense that, you know, he's of Latino background. He had the little water thing that time when he responded. And you know how the media carries on with things, but I think that he's improved himself a lot. And Marco Rubio, I believe, being from Florida, of course, says a lot why he's even in the race, because Jeb Bush is from Florida, he is, and they were friends, but Rubio sees a problem out there. So I think Rubio's a contender, too.
Rand Paul.
Definite contender. He really made a mistake when he began. Don't go fighting the media about how they're asking you a question. He got way off track. But Rand Paul has filled that kind of vacuum of younger people. Obama really, you know, ignited them, his first election. Rand Paul, a lot of younger people are looking towards Rand Paul, not that they decide all the elections, but Rand Paul fills, I think, a bit of a vacuum out there, so I think he's a player.
Mike Huckabee.
I stand a better chance to be president of the United States to win the nomination than Mike Huckabee. Mike Huckabee is out there defending, you know, well, those were past sins by, the family research guy. And he's just kind of obsessed with the world of gays and being, you know, I don't know, not trying to be disrespectful here, but, you know, the Bible is the number one biggest deal to him, and he can't get off every issue. The answer is the Bible. So I just think he's out of it, period.
Ted Cruz.
Ted Cruz is scary. he's gone. He's not even going to be a factor in this race. I mean, I know, you know, he's a guy that says where he stands on things. You can appreciate that, but he was obsessed with one thing with the health care, has stumbled on a few questions. He's just not a player.
Ben Carson.
Now, this is interesting. Ben Carson, if you look at the numbers, is doing better than most of everybody you mentioned, except for Rand Paul and Rubio. I think Ben Carson is a very interesting factor in this race and is still to be watched. I think he can be a player or maybe help to be a kingmaker.
Chris Christie.
No. Had he gotten into this and seriously got into it and said, I'm in it, instead of, you know, running around as the way he did, and I know he had the whole bridge fiasco, but, you know, Christie was a guy that was kind of one of those refreshing guys. He's not the hair-blown candidate. He's overweight, but kind of says what's on his mind, but he waited far, far too late to get into this thing.
Rick Perry.
Nope. I know he changed his boots into dress shoes. It's not going to happen.
Not How about there. The other Rick, Santorum?
No, I served with Rick Santorum. And this is very fascinating. Look, last election, Mitt Romney versus Rick Santorum. Who's the darling of the conservatives? Rick Santorum. Who was the biggest liberal on planet Earth for a Republican? Mitt Romney. Who won the primary? Mitt Romney. So Rick Santorum is not a player in this. Ted Cruz is going to do better than Rick Santorum. They're kind of the same type of mold philosophically, but no, Rick Santorum is not a player in it.
John Kasich.
If my Ohio governor, and I used to share a county, by the way, a congressional seat, we shared a county, Licking County. If John Kasich would today say, I'm in this, here I go, he would be a player right up there with Rubio, Rand Paul. He'd be right up there. But he's not doing that, so right now I'm not putting a lot of faith in him.
We already spoke about Carly Fiorina and Bobby Jindal, so let's talk about Lindsey Graham.
no way under the sun. I don't know what Lindsey Graham's even doing. You know, he came out with a statement about, you know, he was in pool halls. He knows Iranians are liars. If you look at Lindsey's age, he was in pool halls before the revolution, had nothing to do with whether Iranian Americans tell the truth or not. I mean, he's just... I don't know if John McCain talked him into this for amusement purposes or what.
Now, Congressman, before we get to our last issue, because we're almost out of time, do you want to announce your candidacy for president on the show right now?
Against Lindsey Graham, yes, I will beat him.
You're a good sport. Thank you. I want to ask you about this case in Cleveland. Police officer Michael Brillo was acquitted by a judge a couple days ago for the killing of two unarmed people in a car. What are your views on that decision?
Well, you know, there was 127 shots. They singled Brillo out because he climbed on the hood and fired 15 more into the car. Now, the court system, you know, has spoken, but... you know, the DOJ, Department of Justice, is selling a probe. They're involved in Maryland. Here's the bottom line. I mean, to me, I wasn't in the courtroom, but I'm sitting there thinking, okay, he was singled out, but for the reason of on the hood, 15 more shots after 127 were fired. I don't know how he got cleared on this thing, but there's a bigger picture to this entire issue. And it goes beyond just the Department of Justice going in and looking at the history of Cleveland. And there's good and bad on both sides. But until somebody decides we're going to take a look at the bigger picture of militarization, the picture of aggressive, whether it's black or white, and again, aggression on some of these shootings where a teenage girl goes in a police department, she pulls out a knife and there's 9 rounds fired into her. So I don't know where all this settles, but I can tell you this: just one case like this is not going to be the end of it. And justice coming in and, you know, taking control of Cleveland is not going to be the end of it. Somebody along the line has to be interested enough to look at, you know, historic pictures of issues and what we really are doing and how we've ended up with some horrific cases of, again, I want protected, and there's some good police out there, but horrific cases of people just being gunned down, sometimes, you know, whether they're white or black.
Now, the Michael Brillo case, I think one thing that the public has sort of missed amongst all the noise and the smoke is that the judge who issued this acquittal, he didn't find that police officer Michael Brillo didn't do it. What he found was simply that he couldn't find beyond a reasonable doubt that Michael Brillo was guilty of the voluntary manslaughter charges that were pending. Mostly because, as I understand it, because there were so many shooters that it was hard to decipher who actually caused the death of those two people. You're talking about 127 shots. So I think that, you know, sometimes the public, you know, has a very binary view of our trials, in that they think, well, you're either guilty or you're innocent. And that's not the case. In the Brillo case, I think you have a situation where the judge is not saying he's innocent. He's just saying the prosecution didn't prove the case to the beyond the reasonable doubt standard, which is a high one.
That's right. And, so, but yeah. And people end up, and like you said, that binary look, and then people end up saying, well, you know, now Cleveland's been seized by the Department of Justice, and they'll get down to the bottom of it. Well, not necessarily. There's got to be a bigger picture look at, you know, of these situations. And again, I just want to throw out the militarization out there.
Congressman, former Congressman Bob Ney, thank you so much for joining us.
So
I look forward to you coming back a third time, real soon.
Oh, yes, sir. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Okay, now let's go, before we get to Beth Karras, let's answer the question of the day. Question: in the United States since 2005, of the 54 law enforcement officers charged with shooting and killing a person in the line of duty, how many of the 54 have been convicted? Answer: 11 of the 54 law enforcement officers have been convicted to date. 18 of the 54 cases are pending. 22 of those charged were not convicted. The most recent acquittal, as we just spoke about with former Congressman Bob Ney, came in the case of Cleveland police officer Michael Brillo, who was found not guilty by a judge Saturday of the 2012 shooting deaths of Timothy Russell and Melissa Williams, while three officers pleaded guilty in deals resulting in no felony conviction. Anybody who wants further details about these 54 officers charged with killing people in the last 10 years, you can go to www.washingtonpost.com/graphics/investigations/police-shootings. This article came out before the Michael Brillo acquittal. So the breakdown is off by one, which I gave you the correct numbers for on this show. Now, give me Beth Karras. Give me a kiss.
What can I do? Talkin' Law Radio brings you a live Karras on Crime special report from Beth Karras, former prosecutor, Court TV, HLN television correspondent, and founder of KarrasOnCrime.com. Now here's Beth with the latest legal news.
Beth, what can I do?
Good morning, Beth.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm fine. Keeping busy.
Great. Before we get into it, Beth, we're going to talk about the Colorado Theater shooting trial, James Holmes. But before we get into this Colorado Theater shooting trial, which is rolling along, I have a piece of audio tape that I would like to listen to. So, Mark, please play the tape.
It says, "The Obsession to Kill. Since I was a kid, with age became more and more realistic. Started as the entire world with nuclear bombs, then shifted to biological agent that destroys the mind. Most recently, serial murder via a cell phone, stun gun, and folding knife in national forests." So it's titled Case the Place, and then there are three bullets, specific bullet marks. Targets, random. The cruel twists of fate are unkind to the misfortunate. Method, colon, bombs, an X, in parentheses, too regulated and suspicious. Biological warfare, there's an X, parentheses, too impatient, requires extensive knowledge, chemicals, and equipment. Serial murder, there's an X, in parentheses, too personal, too much evidence, easily caught, few kills. Mass murder slash spree, check mark, in parentheses, maximum casualties. Easily performed with firearms, although primitive in nature. No fear of consequences, being caught 99% certain.
So, Beth, we just heard audio of a prosecution witness reading from the notebook of defendant James Holmes. Help us understand what was happening in court yesterday by the reading of that notebook.
Right, sure. This notebook has been under seal for most of the pendency of this case. So the contents, details of the contents have been a mystery, and this was our first look at it yesterday. There'll be more to come, I'm sure. This Aurora police sergeant, an investigator, read certain pages the prosecution asked him to read. Of course, the defense got up and had him read a couple other pages and certain entries that sounded a little bit irrational and nonsensical, each side using this notebook that Holmes created in the weeks and months before the massacre to their benefit. Now, the notebook was mailed by Holmes to his university psychiatrist just before the massacre. The massacre was July, in the wee hours of July 20th, 2012, just after midnight, and they confiscated it from the mailroom at the University of Colorado a couple of days later. And he admitted that he had sent this, and they knew what they were looking for, but they didn't know if there was something dangerous in it. So the bomb squad, was looking at the package and making sure that it wasn't a dangerous item to open. In any event, this is a real look inside his mind and what was going on. The problem is, it's not dated, so you don't know exactly when entries were made, but in his against him, at a disadvantage to him, are entries like that he needed to research firearms and mental illness, and that, I keep saying, has really jumped out at me, that he needed to research mental illness. It's no question he's mentally ill, but was he researching it to the point where he, wanted to make sure there were entries intentionally that made him look crazier than he is? Was he thinking about an insanity defense, knowing 99% chance he was going to get caught because of that is what he wrote, and that is indeed what happened? He had himself covered up in body armor to protect himself. This was not going to be a suicide by cop situation. He'd kill as many people as possible and then be killed himself.
You're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking with legal analyst Beth Karas of KarasOnCrime.com, who's helping us understand what's happening in the James Holmes Colorado Theater shooting trial case. Yesterday, there was a testimony about a notebook of the defendant. And Beth, I didn't hear the defense excerpts, which were entered into evidence, but the audio that we just listened to seems to me to be really powerful evidence, which may be persuasive to a jury, showing that not only did this defendant know what he was doing, but he was meticulous. I mean, if you listen to that tape we just listened to, he's basically doing a process of elimination analysis of how he should commit murders. He's saying, well, serial killing is too personal and bombs take too much, scientific expertise. Am I wrong?
No, you are not. He ruled out an airport because it might be mistaken for terrorism, and this wasn't about terrorism. He writes about the actual Aurora Century 16 theater complex that he ended up targeting and how he went through there are 16 auditoriums within it, right? And he rules out, he goes there different times because there's evidence that he bought tickets to that theater on three different dates, and he's ruling out certain auditoriums within there. No good, three exits. He picked one, and he picked Theater 9 because of the possibility of maximum casualties. I mean, he bought handcuffs, at least in his writings, handcuffs could secure the exit doors, the double doors, just handcuff them and prevent people from from leaving. He has in his notebook, response time, 3 minutes. Now, we had heard an opening statement from the prosecutor that he had researched the Columbine, Colorado massacre, and the response time of the police there, and it was 3 minutes. So he figured 3 minutes for himself, and that's in the notebook as well. In fact, it was actually half that time. It was about 90 seconds before police were there. Anyway, he found a theater where he could kill as many people as possible as quickly as possible.
Now, on balance, do you think that this notebook evidence helped the prosecution more or helped the defense more? I would assume it helped the prosecution more.
Well, at this point, it appears to help the prosecution more, absolutely. As you say, he's so meticulous in his planning and ruling out certain options and stating why. This is a look inside, you know, a madman's head, and I say madman in the, you know, general sense. I don't mean that he's insane under the law, because I don't think that that's a burden. Well, the burden's on the state to prove sanity, but I think this is a tough road to hoe for the defense. It's all they have, of course. No one will dispute that he's mentally ill. The question is he insane under the law? This notebook, you know, early on, there's a defense investigator, apparently there's a voicemail the judge is now allowing into evidence, where a defense investigator said he didn't want this to get into the state's hands. You know, he was hoping to keep it within the defense camp. So much for that. But we'll hear a lot more about this as both sides use this notebook to support their positions. So we've now, only had our first look at it, so I can't tell you if it's going to help one side more or the other.
Now, Beth, I want to be sensitive to our listeners who, unlike me and you, are not always consumed and with these issues, and a lot of our listeners are not lawyers. So can you just break down for our listeners the difference between legal insanity and mental insanity or mental illness, which would rise
right
to that level?
Right. Mental illness, I mean, many people have mental illnesses, right? And they're everything from, you know, just a little depression now and then to, you know, paranoid schizophrenia, and there's a whole spectrum. And mental illness, just because you're mentally ill doesn't mean you're insane under the law. Generally speaking, insanity means you don't know right from wrong. You don't actually understand what the consequences of your actions are. You don't know they're wrong. You think that the gun in your hand is really a banana, you know, something as, you know, outlandish as that. This, what this defendant did, the Colorado shooter did, shows he knew right from wrong. I mean, he was meticulous in his planning, and he was trying to kill as many people as possible before he got caught. He knew it was wrong. He knew he was going to get caught. But anyway, the bottom line is you could be mentally ill, and our prisons are full of mentally ill people, but it doesn't mean you didn't know right from wrong.
Well, speaking of another horrendous, tragic case, I want to switch gears just a bit and talk about the Darren Dillon Wint D.C. quadruple murder case, which is really a terrible homicide which caused the deaths of Savas Savalopoulos, his wife Amy, his young son Philip, and their housekeeper Viralisha Figueroa. What can you tell us about the status of that case, Beth?
Well, you know, it is believed that he did not do this alone. He worked, the man in custody, Dwint, worked for the company that the family owned. But I, you know, it is believed there's a connection between the employment or somebody in his family who was employed. It was some sort of retaliation, but that he didn't do it alone. I mean, killing four people has, you know, we know of cases where people have been able to kill four people alone, but they believe that others have done it, and they're looking for accomplices.
So the other people, if there are accomplices, nobody else has been arrested except that one defendant, last name Wint.
That's my understanding. Right, correct. I mean, staying up on reports out of D.C.
Right. And is there a next court appearance scheduled in that case? Do we know?
I'm not sure if there's a next court appearance yet. Maybe? No. I know that the funeral is June 1st, but I'm not sure about the next court appearance. Sorry about that.
Okay. So let's talk about a case where I know that they are in court. This is the case in Manhattan, Dewey and LaBeouf, which was a law firm of 1,300 lawyers, which was a merger of two old white shoe law firms. And on trial right now are three former executives, Stephen Davis, Stephen DeCarmine, Joel Sanders, who are charged by the Manhattan DA's office with larceny, fraud, falsifying business records. And I believe opening statements began yesterday, and one of the attorneys, defense attorneys, will give his opening statement this morning. What do you think's going to happen with that case, Beth?
Well, you know, this is going to be a long trial, 4 to 6 month trial. They are going to be calling, the state is going to be calling 7 cooperators, all of whom have pled guilty, some of whom, if they're truthful in their testimony, will get non-incarceration sentences, and another who will be recommended, you know, 2 to 6 years if he's cooperating truthfully. So, I mean, this doesn't...
And these cooperators,
well.
These cooperators are former Dewey employees,
well,
my understanding is.
Who are going to apparently testify that the firm, you know, real, the term is cooked its books, they entered false entries to make their financial health of the law firm look much better than it was, so that they wouldn't break promises to banks and lenders. And, you know, even the prosecutor said in his opening statement yesterday that it's not going to be the most riveting of testimony, because it's going to involve a lot of emails, and it's a, you know, it's a white-collar case, and it's a lot of paper. But what these individuals did in paying themselves millions of dollars in salary while others were being laid off at the firm and the firm was absolutely falling apart is just, it's as bad as going out and committing a violent crime against someone else, because they hurt people's livelihoods while enriching themselves.
And I thought it was pretty interesting. I read some of the reports about Elkin Abramowitz's opening statements, who I believe is the attorney for Stephen Davis. And Elkin Abramowitz, of course, is one of the deans of the White Collar Defense Bar here in New York. And he basically said that, you know, it wasn't his client who committed any crimes. Basically, the firm imploded, according to Abramowitz, because there were partners who jumped ship and took business with them and caused the implosion. It was basically sort of like a run on a bank, but instead of a bank, a law firm.
And it's a good defense, because when partners jump ship, go to another law firm, and take those clients, it's a real financial hit on a law firm. However, again, according to the prosecutor's opening statement, I mean, they have email exchanges where, you know, they talk about one of the cooperators getting a little bit skittish, or, oh, maybe he knows too much, maybe it's time to, like, you know, have lunch with him and kind of calm him down. And, you know, I don't know that these emails are, you know, actually spell out, hey, let's make sure he falsifies the entries, but it's kind of dancing around it, and it may be good evidence, coupled with the witness's testimony, who was the target.
Well, I think that today the attorney for Joel Sanders will be giving his opening statement, and after that we'll get into the evidence in the Dewey LaBeouf case. Beth, before we leave each other, what's new on KarasonCrime.com?
Well, I continue to follow the Holmes trial. The Colorado Theater shooting trial is what I'm primarily following right now. But I'm ready very soon to launch my new site, which will include a little book corner, because I want to start promoting books, a lot of books in the legal field primarily. And so I'm very excited about that. And I also am just following other legal stories around the country, but primarily right now it's the James Holmes trial.
Beth Karas, KarasOnCrime.com. Beth, thanks so much as always for joining us.
My pleasure.
I want to thank Bob Ney, former congressman from the great state of Ohio and author of Sideswiped. Go get his book at Amazon.com. Beth Karas, KarasOnCrime.com, thank you for helping us understand the James Holmes D.C. quadruple murder and Dewey LaBeouf ongoing cases. Mark Goldman, our producer, thank you so much for doing such a great job. Please remember to like our Facebook/TalkinLaw. Follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, HOCHHEISER. Send me an email. TalkinLaw@gmail.com. TalkinLaw@gmail.com. No G in talking. I'd like to hear what you think of the show. Suggest a guest. Ask a question. Make a comment. I'd love to hear from you. I would like to wish all our listeners peace and justice. Until next Wednesday. Thank you.